Went to a concert last night. Had something devastating happen to me.
Ooh.
Well, it's a couple things. One, it was an all ages show.
Okay.
I've noticed that I don't like feeling old at a show.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. I didn't enjoy that.
I'm going to be honest. You're old at a show, man.
No, but the thing is, Simon, a lot of shows I go to are still of bands that are from people that were older than me that passed it down slightly.
Right.
So it's like, I'm a big fan of, say, like 90s punk and 90s hip hop.
Mm-hmm.
Those are, if you do me a Spotify rap every single year,
yeah.
It's like, these are the genres. And then even usually the bands that I like as a primary, usually built off of those two things in terms of the trickle down.
Gotcha.
This was a newer emo band that I wasn't even like really sure, or like I wasn't even aware that they were that new, to be honest. Like, I didn't know too much about them. I was just like, I liked an album.
Mm-hmm.
And then I liked their new album. I was like, oh, okay, like this band is pretty good. I'm gonna go see them. And when I arrived, it was like, oh, this is younger people. This is their thing. And I was like, that's fine. You know, whatever. No big deal. But just looking around, I was like, normal concert behavior bothered me. And
sure.
You know, when we were talking about Ennis and I earlier in the week about being old guys and doing old guy stuff.
Yeah.
That was a true being an old guy moment where I just had to be like present and go, don't do that.
Yeah.
What are you doing? That's anybody at a concert. Like, if I'm at any show and people are like bumping you or doing stupid stuff, or as you know, you're just, I don't think twice. And all of a sudden it's youths. And I was
it's a 17-year-old.
There was a
and
kid,
you're like, get out of here.
No, dude. So there was a kid that was right beside me that was just vaping. And for a second I was like, oh, it's so annoying. And then I'm like, dude, when you were 17, you used to smoke cigarettes inside stadiums all the time.
Sure.
At shows. You did that every single time. Like, what are you talking about?
Way to catch yourself, though.
Yeah, it was outrageous. But okay, but I still got to say, it took me out of it for a second. When
sure.
I was in it, though, it was good. But I was judgmental of things like, there was like crowd surfing going on, a lot of crowd surfing. And I kept going, that's not how we used to do it. You know, wow, that's a safe, you can crowd surf holding your phone out, like, not my day. Stuff like that. And they were trying to get a mosh pit going, and it wasn't. And I was like, man, it was me in there. I was moshing. I was like,
I've never failed getting the pit started.
Like, yeah, that's what I mean. It was just stuff like that where I was so lame, and I went, man, you're the
You never tapped
dude.
The guy next to you and went, up.
But the real devastating part was, so because it's an all-ages show, it's wristbands.
Mm.
And I'm walking around. I go up to grab a beer, and I haven't been to an all-ages show in a long time, so
sure.
I go get a beer. And the lady behind the till is like, you got to go get a wristband. I'm like, can I just show you my ID? Like, what are we doing here? There's no lines. Just let's get this going. And she's like, no, those guys over there should have wristbands. I'm like, fine, I'll go over there. Girl I'm with, they're like, can I see some ID? And I was like, oh, yeah, you know, all right, I'm getting ready to do it too. And the guy just looks at me. He's like, you're good. I was upset. I got a baby face, okay? The downside of the baby face is that you feel like there's a lot of scenarios where you don't command enough respect that I feel you deserve as a man, especially if it's a work thing, right? Sometimes I feel as though there will be people in the building that'll talk sort of down to me like I'm a younger person or like I don't have, you know, the bona fides of, you know, 10 years of successful podcasts and radio shows. And that will irk me sometimes. The one positive of having the baby face is that when you go to an all-ages show, they ask you for ID. So now I'm in the murky middle. Is that what I'm to learn? Is that what I learned yesterday? If it is to be, it's not good. Anyways, the show was fine. The show was good. I really enjoyed the band. It's nice to be able to get out and do some other stuff. But then I get home, and it's pretty much right into work mode, which is weird because you do this stuff now to de-stress in this job where you'll be like, okay, I need to get outside of it and I need to get outside of it. But then work accumulates outside of you and then it feels like you got to kind of rush it in. And so I kind of watched the Leafs game. I watched it on, you know, fast forwarding through some stuff and making sure commercials goes through. It's not the same kind of watch. I ended up listening to Leafs talk. Actually, this morning when I woke up, I was just like on my commute in, and there was a couple things I wanted to say from this game. One is, this is my main takeaway. It is the ultimate dog days again for the Toronto Maple Leafs. We're back here where there's just no stakes in the standings. And so I'm not trying to, I know everybody gets defensive whenever you bring up this player, but I watch William Nylander in that game and it's moments of brilliance. He scores in the power play, but then it's just some Nylander stuff where you go, oh my God. And lately he's been this way where the points have accumulated. He's been tearing it up from a point standpoint. But I think, you know, the attention to detail in the game has been a lot sloppier than it was early on in the season. Far more turnovers, far more reckless plays. Yeah, just not nearly as much back-checking. He's been kind of in all-star mode, and that's fine. This isn't a criticism of him. I think it's more so just the idea of where we're at in the calendar. For most teams, this time of the season is a challenge. But this new playoff format, and, you know, I was thinking about GM meetings, and we were discussing with Bourne yesterday about, yeah, what's the topic that you'd want to bring up if you're down there? It's just this playoff format has got to go. This cannot continue where you're compounding the dog days of a tough regular season slog of an 82-game season, and now you're adding to that even more devalued regular season games because so many teams are basically set. And the only races that we're watching is what, the Eastern Conference playoff race? Like, enjoy watching. You just saw Philly. They're trash. They're no good. That's not a good hockey team. They're benching their captain. They're in disarray. It's not. They were lucky to win that hockey game. They really were. It was a million posts, and Toronto went to sleep for a couple of moments, and they banged out a couple of goals. You're going to see Washington tonight. I promise you, Washington stinks. Even if they win this game, who cares? They stink. You don't care about that. The Red Wings have gone into a complete tank. They're blaming a patch on their jersey. Things are so bad that they've got the fans in complete disarray. This format just sucks. And one thing I thought was, and not to make excuses for the group, I think we, you know, there's enough people that do enough of that. But one of the what ifs for me about this team, and it hadn't even dawned on me until last night or when I was watching it or this morning when I was thinking about it, is what if this team didn't always have this level of dog days? What if it was, hey, there's competitive games down the stretch that you're playing in year after year after year, rather than constantly being able to go into coast mode, chill mode, non-competitive mode for, you know, 2 months before the playoffs start every single year. And I think that's a real failing of the league. Again, you're a professional athlete. That's what the money's for. You're supposed to dig in. You're supposed to do stuff, blah, 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 blah. All I'm saying is it is an interesting thing that happened with this core at this time, just like people can say about the restricted free agency and them changing it and the dynamics of the salary cap and getting hit with the pandemic. We do all these big what ifs, but that one really does never get raised. Anyways, James Myrtle, senior managing editor at The Athletic. He's on the line. He's listening to that little rant. What's up, buddy? How are we doing?
I'm good. I totally agree with you. The 1-8, there was always something to play for because it's like, oh, now we're in sixth, now we're in fifth in the East, like keep pushing. And there was something to play for, you know, that you would be fighting for your home ice all the way through. And this has been a problem for the Leafs for a while. Like I remember going to games and being on the road 2018, 2019, and they would have locked away not only being in the playoffs, not only what seed they were in, but who they were playing. And it would be like early March.
Yeah.
And you know, the players are never going to say it, but you can just tell. And I think what you've hit on is 100% true, that in reality, these games don't matter. They don't matter at all. It's like you're back in exhibition season. And, you know, I think you would love your team to be able to play through that and just, you know, and some teams can, and the Leafs have never been a team that could. Some teams can play those meaningless games and just push through and just keep winning. And that's not really been in their DNA. So it's been a problem for them for a long time. And I think that the players have just gotten used to it being this way, that, you know, there's not really a real playoff push.
But this is the thing, part where I go, damn, can you blame them? It'd be one thing. Okay. If this was, part of me wants to be frustrated with the team, and this is actually what sucks as a viewer, is they let in an early goal, and you go, damn it, and the first one is a weird one, but the second one, you're like, man, come on, you know, wake up. This is the beginnings of periods. Just figure this out. This is the same thing with you guys over and over again. And I go, how can I be mad? It's every year of this. This isn't 1 year of it. You want to think, hey, they are trying to materially change their playoffs, and so materially change the approach going into it. I just don't know how malaise wouldn't set in when you're looking at it and saying there's no stakes here. Nobody cares what we're doing in these games. Just stay healthy. Don't hurt yourself going into the postseason because, yeah, one thing is very clear. You lose any of the four guys, you're dead. You know, you lose any of those four guys, you got zero chance because they are making up half of your cap sheet, right? So you can't lose any of them. And I'm going, it's hard for me to stay locked in as a viewer. I can't imagine that year over year over year you have this where you've built this up. You've built up this callus. Like, how many years have the Leafs had it during this run, right? Like, this iteration of player where they've actually been playing for something meaningful down the stretch. Obviously, the rookie year of everyone where they go and play Washington in the Stanley Cup playoffs, right? Because they were scrapping and clawing. It goes right down to the end. It's Gensel just misses a goal. They beat Pittsburgh. They end up getting in the playoffs. Every single year after that, essentially, has been, you're set. You know what you're doing. You know, outside of you, the year that they were robbed of, where they were falling out of the playoffs, which was the pandemic year, it's always set. It's rinse, repeat. It's the same thing over and over again. And I'm curious, as, you know, someone who loves to text people around the league and get a feel for things, why there isn't more of just that discussion pushing the change for the playoff format?
It gets talked about a little bit, but, you know, they say that they like the division rivalries. They like that it cuts down the, they like that it cuts down the travel. You know, you're playing within your division all the way till the third round. But in the Atlantic, it's, I think in some of the other divisions, it's not quite as stale as it is here. You're right. I mean, this is going back to 2018. So it's 6 years, and it's always been, is it Tampa? Is it Boston? Are you in the second seed or the third seed? Do you get home ice or do you not? And for whatever reason, the Leafs are never able to win the division. The only year they win the division is when the Atlantic division doesn't exist.
Yep.
And it's always either Tampa, Florida, or Boston running away with it. And the Leafs kind of just, oh, well, I guess we're second or third. And, you know, our last 20 games don't matter. And it sucks as a viewer. It does. It sucks as someone in the media trying to, like, you're right. Like, that game last night, it doesn't really matter.
What are you supposed to do? Yeah, what are you supposed to do?
It's an exhibition. It's an exhibition. It's to get ready. An injury thing's a good point. Like, that's the most important thing with these games. For, I guess the second most important thing with these games is you're integrating some new players and you're trying some different lines and deep pairs and you're hoping that you hit on something. You're hoping you get some momentum. And I'm sure Sheldon Keefe, when it gets down to 6, 7, 8 games left, he's like, okay, now we got to dial in because we got to be ready. And now we got to start playing harder. And sometimes that works and sometimes it doesn't. So.
Fine. But yeah, for the most part, I feel like there's going to be a little juice for Leafs Oilers this weekend because it's Connor McDavid and he always takes this matchup seriously. He's coming to Toronto. There's going to be a chance for him likely in the building. Zach Hyman's return. You know, these two teams play each other pretty tough. I think that they do have a bit of measuring stick as the Canadian team from the last half decade between each other. So to me, there is something to that. Maybe you get something from the next Sabres game that's on the 30th because, again, Dahlin and Matthews hate each other, but the last time they played, it was a dog's breakfast, so can't really count on that. And then, yeah, you've got a couple Panthers games and a couple Lightning games in April that you could say are measuring stick games, but if you're Toronto, like, it's a back-to-back to close the year. You think that's going to be the most intense hockey games? Like, you think you're going to extend the Florida and Tampa series? I just, looking at the schedule, I don't see a lot there where you're going to say this is going to be awesome hockey or you're going to learn much from this hockey. And that's frustrating. And I would say this, the counter to it, and even as I'm hearing it to you or from you about the frustration, is if I was Keefe or I was the organization looking at the players through a critical lens, I'd be going, well, guys, you didn't have to be in third. You know, you could have had something to fight for had you won more games. You could have had home ice throughout the playoffs. You could have tried to push for a President's Trophy. But again, the regular season has been so devalued for this group and in this league that I kind of find it hard to criticize them for that, too. They're also doing it where every single year they've got to turn over the roster. And so the first couple of months of the season are basically exploratory. Last year, they turned over the entire roster at the deadline. It's just, yeah, I want to be critical of some things, but I find it to be really, really difficult when you look at the circumstances around them and say, well, yeah, okay, seems a little foolish. Seems like they're more, they're not a victim of circumstance, but you know what I'm saying by calling them that.
Yeah. I mean, I guess if they change the playoff format, how do you weigh in on adding more teams and having a play-in and stuff like that? Do you think that's a good idea?
I heard Elliot make the most compelling case for it when he was on Chicklets. I would say that in general, I am more of a traditionalist when it comes to this. I just think it's the same thing with March Madness. There's, to me, in sports right now, there are two things that just undeniably work. It's the first round of the Stanley Cup playoffs, and it's March Madness. Mm-hmm. And when they try to tinker with those things, I get really defensive because baseball, I kind of think screwed it up a little bit. Baseball was supposed to be a really cool, you need to be locked into the regular season because they matter so much and the margins for not making it are so fine because if you get in, you can win. And now last year they have a team in the Arizona Diamondbacks that makes it to the World Series and they were mediocre at best. And I don't like watching that in MLB playoffs. And I don't like the feeling like bad teams make the postseason. The Blue Jays last year were a bad team and they made the playoffs. Don't really love it. Hockey is perfect, you know? It's just the first round is so intense. You want to watch it. Basketball had to screw around with theirs. The NBA had to screw around because we were getting basically lifeless matchups the entire first round, right? You didn't have to tune in for it whatsoever. So they go, why don't we add a play-in game? We're changing the dynamics of the league when it comes to luxury taxes. More, there's going to be more parity within the NBA. Let's give this a shot. And I go, yeah, that's fine. NFL is so big. It's a behemoth. There's so much money that you go, yeah, guess what? They're going to find ways to monetize more games. I'm sorry. This is the biggest game in town. Hockey. I'm back and forth on it because I like Elliot's argument, but I also just go, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And God, you never put the toothpaste back in the tube with stuff like this, right? Once you go down that path, you can never go back.
Yeah. I think the thing is, for a team like the Leafs, having the play-ins for other teams, because you're finishing ahead of them, it helps you a little bit. Like, at least makes it worth something to finish in the top six in your conference, because you don't have to play those extra games, right? And then you could just have, like, a one game or a best of three or something, and then the real first round starts after that. I think that's the way you would have to do it.
I got to be honest. I think that the most obvious and best playoff format is what the PWHL just did. And they had the guts to do it, and the NHL doesn't seem like they ever would, especially since it's such a boys' club, right? There's so many relationships in hockey that people would never want to step on each other's toes by doing it, but by far the right thing to do is it's 1 versus 8, but if you're the number one team, you get to pick your opponent. You're number two, you get to pick the next one down. Like, that's the way she goes. You want rivalries? Like, that's the thing that I hate about this, is they go, we want rivalries, we want rivalries. What would better ensure a rivalry than a team picking their opponent, right? Like, look how big a story it was when Leaf fans, teenagers, cheered We Want Florida in Maple Leaf Square, how offensive that was to the Florida Panthers and to the establishment in the hockey. It was like, oh, wow, you called them out and you lost. How great would that be is if you ever had a series where Boston picked Toronto, you know? Like, imagine that. Imagine they go, we think we got these guys' numbers. We think they're soft. We dominate them every single playoffs. We beat them both. We swept them in the regular season. We want them. Give them to us. Boy, that'd be pretty juicy. That would add the stakes, right? I hate this playoff format. I know you're right. It's affected the Atlantic more, and so we're looking at it very much through our lens. But I don't think it's worked at all. And I know this show is how does it affect the Leafs. It is definitely, in my opinion, affected the Leafs in a negative standpoint, especially with the composition of the way that their team is built.
Yeah, no, I mean, I agree entirely. And, you know, what was wrong with 1 versus 8? And the thing with the rivalries too, is we've had really good playoff rivalries between teams that aren't in the same division.
No duh.
Like, I think back to like Vancouver, Chicago, like there's tons of examples.
Yeah. Do you think that, like, we suffered not having Caps Pens was just because they were in the same division? Like, that was built on 1 versus 8. We still had Sid versus Ovi. You just wanted to see the best teams play each other. And eventually you kind of get that come postseason time. I hate it. And this kind of gets to something, you know, I actually want to touch on with you today. And maybe we'll just pivot here before we get back into some Leaf stuff. The March meetings stuff annoyed me. And I don't know if you heard any of my segment yesterday with Bourne, but this is basically a retreat for the general managers, which is fine. Call it that. Say general managers retreat. I'm tired of this being like league meetings as though important business is being conducted here. Oh, no more guys putting their leg over the board on shifts. Okay. Ooh, what a foundational change. Okay, now we're going to review puck over the glass. Ooh, la, la. Wow, you guys are really cracking the atom down there in Florida. Ooh, every year it's the same thing. Everything's fine. Everything's fine. Ooh, this year it's about letting Peros have it. Okay, what's the change? Well, nothing, but they're going to let them have it, apparently. Ooh, shaking in my boots. What a lovely time to be a sports fan. There have been major issues with this league year over year over year, and they continue to just say, yeah, you know, whatever, we're going to leave them. I don't get it. Like, I don't know what we're supposed to do. I don't know what we're supposed to say. But playoff format, to me anyways, continues to be, this is what, year six of me going, this has got to be the major point of contention. And like you just said, they barely bring it up. They barely table it.
Yeah, I think that sometimes they struggle to see it from the fans' perspective, right? Like, and I think that, you know, that, and the other thing too is I think a board of governors meeting, there would be some of the more serious business gets done, and there's more interesting things that come out of that. At the GM meeting in March, I mean, our guys that were going down there were like, I don't think there's going to be anything there. It's,
yeah,
it's really, it's kind of like a schmooze. Yeah. I mean, they're networking, right? Like, they're setting up, like, I'm sure the guys that are out of the playoffs, they're setting up what their offseason is going to look like, and, you know, maybe making a deal or looking at free agents or whatever. Like, you know, so there's business happening there. It's just not the stuff that's going to come out in the headlines, you know, the day that it ends. I know that there's some LTIR stuff coming that is kind of interesting. Like, it sounds like there's going to be a push for something actually to happen with that, and maybe that's like the biggest thing that comes out of that.
If you were down there, you know, let's put it this way, if you were a GM and it couldn't be the schedule, is there anything else that you would table that you would try to champion seriously?
Oh man. I think 3-2-1 for the playoff or the points format, I think that's long, long overdue. And I think that would change the way that teams play down the stretch too, because if all of a sudden, if you're a team that's on the outside, like let's say you're New Jersey, if you go on a run and you win a whole bunch of games in regulation and you get 3 points, all of a sudden you can gain. Mm-hmm. And I think that would put teams higher up on notice too. Like in theory, the Leafs could string together a whole bunch of regulation games and maybe have a chance at catching Florida or Boston. Whereas the way the playoff or the point format is now, the way the standings work, it's impossible to catch anybody. Mm-hmm. So I would bring that in.
I much prefer that than adding an extra playoff team. Like I would rather they tinkered with that first before they tinkered with adding the wild card rounds and having that happen, you know? Like that makes more sense to me, and it at least could add some excitement. It is a different look. That actually is, I think that what we're driving at here is that the NHL clearly needs a shakeup to its regular season. You know, like there needs to be a shakeup to change the dog days a little bit, because it was one thing to do that in a less competitive media environment. But now, as other leagues are trying to get more creative, and as other leagues, I think, are doing a pretty good job of figuring out ways to get new fans, or at least being aggressive in trying new ways. Like, I don't think that the NBA's in-season tournament is a... In hindsight, you look at it and go, it's kind of corny now. Like, the Lakers won. They suck. And the Pacers were there, and they suck too. And it's just, but at least they tried something, you know? And I kind of want to see that with the NHL. No more just, hey, nothing and everything's fine. A little bit of aggression, a little bit of acknowledgement that you got to fix the period in the schedule of post-trade deadline to playoffs, because it's, I think it's a slog for everybody. Okay, so back to the Leafs. Here's my other thought off that game, though. So one is the dog days, and it's hard to criticize. But the other one is, so your cohort, Jonas Siegel, he pointed out that the Leafs, I think now they have 15 different goal scorers in 18 games. I think that's what it is, because he did it a couple of games ago and it was 14 and 16, and then Nick Robertson scored and we've played 2 games since. So they're getting a greater distribution of goal scoring on the roster right now, which is a good thing. But you're watching these lines every night and they continue to remain jumbled. And we keep getting different looks. And yeah, part of it is that you have a Marner and Yarncroc injury. But same thing with the blue line, is it doesn't really feel like there's anything that you can hang your hat on outside of Marner and Matthews eventually returning together. And I'm curious how big an issue you think that is going to be down the stretch. If we just have to accept that, if that's actually something that they should be trying to find out, like, where are you at with that part of this team? Because it's, to me, it's very strange the way that they're built right now, which is, I don't know where anybody's supposed to actually play at the end of the day.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think Sheldon Keefe knows where anyone should be right now. I think, yeah. I think he's searching for something and he's looking, and what he wants to do is get down to that last 6, 7, 8 games and get dialed into what he thinks the playoff lineup is and keep them together at that point. So, you know, part of the game's not meaning anything or mattering is that he can tinker all he wants. And he's a guy who likes to tinker and likes the line blender. And like, now's the time when he can, you got a couple key players out. You're trying to see if you can get any chemistry with some of the depth guys playing with some of your different stars and seeing if there's anything there. And, you know, they're getting looks at, like, what does Domi look like with Matthews? And what does Holmberg look like with Matthews? And, you know, where do I like Dewar? Do I like him on the third line or the fourth line? And just moving some things around. And the other thing I would say too is that I can see scenarios where in the playoffs they're going to have different line combinations for different games, whether it's home or on the road, and they're going to have different line combinations situationally within games. So, you know, just with the personnel that they've got some guys that when you need a goal, you're really going to want to lean on and put them out there. And then if you're trying to protect a lead, they're not going to get out there at all. So I think what Keefe's going to do is he's going to have purpose-built lines. And he's done this in the past a little bit, but I think for sure with this roster, he's going to have all kinds of different lineups. So I think you're going to see, you know, in a playoff series, you're going to see 7, 8 different lines that are going to get a lot of ice time. So I think probably get used to seeing the mix and match thing happening a lot.
I'll say two things on it from yesterday. One is that I have always believed that Domi on the wing with Marner and Matthews deserves a look. And I don't know if it'll ever get one, but I want to see more of Domi with Matthews. I've said it all season long. If you're going to have this guy, play him up there. Don't play him in the weird role. Get enough with this whole, you can't trust him defensively if he's playing with two other guys that are supposed to be elite defensively. Two is, the only thing that kind of drives me nuts is you found something with Tavares McMahon. Like, you did. You figured that out. That was, if you're doing all this exploratory stuff, that works for you. And maybe it's just McMahon kind of does work everywhere, which is good for him. But don't screw with that. Keep Tavares with two guys. Eventually, hopefully, it ends up being Yarncroc, but maybe he ends up getting bumped up the lineup just because they need to, they trust him more and they need him somewhere more. But ultimately, that's what I want to see is let Tavares have a line, you know, let him have McMahon, let him maybe even have Nyes. I don't care. Give him the two choppy guys that go and dig pucks out and let him play with those two. You figured it out. You don't need to tinker with that anymore. Stop. We don't need to see Nick Robertson with John Tavares. It's not going to work.
Yeah. I think the important thing for me is that they keep that Tavares line and they have a Nylander on a different line and they have Matthews on a different line.
That's what I mean.
I think that's what they got to do. Yeah. But I mean, so if Tavares is on his own line and you want Domi up with Matthews and Marner, who's the center on Nylander's line?
Yeah, I know, it's a tough one.
There's nobody. Mm-hmm. That's why I wanted them to go get like a Wennberg or something like that before the deadline, because they needed another option. Like, you can't play Dewar there. It's a big need. And their lineup, like, and I know you don't want to give up a first round pick for him, but if they had Adam Henrique right now, their lineup looks pretty good. Like, that's what they needed, like a guy who can play in the top three lines who can play center, and they just don't have one.
Okay, you know what we've also definitively figured out? You tweeted about it yesterday.
Yeah, Brody.
Well, the Brody Riley thing, stop doing it. This is a dated reference, but this is, stop trying to make Fetch happen. Stop trying to make Brody Riley happen. It's done. Like, we don't, there's 0% chance this can work, in my opinion. And I don't know, I get it. You've got some difficult things on the blue line. You're missing somebody, but why? What possible explanation could Sheldon Keefe give for wanting to trot this back out here?
I think it's just, it worked so well for 3 years. Like, that was their top pair for three seasons, really, you know. Other than when they had Muzzin and they tried Muzzin and Brody a little bit, it was Riley-Brody. Like, I bet that's their most used pairing over the last 3.5 years since they signed Brody to that deal. And it was a good pairing. You know, it would consistently show up as one of the better pairings in the league, you know, over the previous 3 years. So I'm sure you know, it's like the, with coaches, they all have their comfort goats. And I think that the comfort goat for Keefe is that he's used to that working really well. He's used to being able to trust that line to generate off, or that pairing to generate offense and to play against other teams' top lines. Mm. So when he looks at his lineup, he's like, okay, but I agree. I mean, this is the games that don't matter time. This is experiment time. Let's see what else you've got. Let's mix in some other looks. Maybe you want to try Riley with McCabe. Maybe you want to try Edmondson with McCabe. Just to try something else, you know. And I thought, and I think we've beaten on him a little bit, and I know they've been down on him, but I thought Liljegren looked interesting last night. I don't know how you felt about his game, but, you know, he plays close to 22 minutes. He's on PP1. He's out there 6-on-5. And I was like, okay, yeah, I can see. I think using Liljegren in kind of a more offensive role makes sense. Third pair offensive role, get him some more minutes that way. And I would just be trying some more things like that.
I think when Marner comes back, he's immediately off power play one for me, and you're back to Morgan Riley. That this is actually more a sign of, look, this guy was struggling with confidence, and we're trying to still find out more of the things he can do. And like you said, try new things. To me, this is a try new thing, but ultimately shouldn't and likely will not have, it won't be lasting. What I will say is, and I've been bringing this up a lot lately, is because I've been uber critical of Liljegren's game for a very long time. He frustrates me like few others, and it's a very much a roller coaster ride. And I thought Bourne summarized it well, going, yeah, we do this. We talk about how he gets elevated when he has a role that fits him with the Leafs, and then come playoff time, he becomes unplayable because the matchups are tougher and you see the flaws in the game. But his expected goals for 5-on-5 since March, he's number two on the team. Like, he still is, even after yesterday. So I look at it and I'm like, he's playing well in this role. If he can continue to find that role for him, it's great. He's the ultimate to me. I shouldn't say ultimate because it still remains that way with the Stars. But in terms of pieces that could be here around the core, pieces that you're supposed to have, a guy that you should have continuity with, he's a big question mark that, to me, gets settled this year in the playoffs. Like, what happens with him this year in the postseason? If you have to bench him again, or if we're having those conversations, I think it's move-on time. And if he performs admirably, I think you go, okay, you know what? Good for you for sticking with it. Good for you for finding and being patient with this young player and accepting him for who he is. And now he inks a, I would say, not a long-term deal, but maybe a medium one.
I thought when they brought in Lyubushkin and Edmondson, I was like, okay, here we go.
Same.
You know, Liljegren's going back to be the number seven. They're not going to take Benoit out. They're going to go with kind of like a bunch of butchers on the blue line and go real tough. And they didn't do that. And that's interesting. And again, it could be like an end of regular season thing where they're like, let's give Liljegren a real run here to see what he can do. And he's had some stretches this year where he's been terrible, but then he's also had stretches. And again, like I was arguing with Jonas last night, he didn't like his game last night. I just thought, you know, you give him some more minutes in offensive situations and he stands out because they've got so many guys on the blue line that can't move the puck, that can't do anything offensively. And I think they need him. They need him to at least be able to be a third pair guy who can help them in offensive situations. And when you need a goal late in the game, you don't want to be putting, you want Riley and Liljegren out there within the last minute and a half of the game if you're going with two defensemen. Yeah. You know, he can make a pass, he can move it up the ice. It looks a lot better than Brody or Edmondson or Lyubushkin. I mean, you don't want any of those guys out there late in the game. So it's very, very interesting that they're going to give him a shot, you know, after it not working so many times. And it's possible they get good Liljegren, but you're right. I mean, we've seen it so many times where they get down to when the games matter and he's up in the press box eating popcorn.
Mm-hmm. And this is part of it too, though, is when you talk about those guys and when we're evaluating Liljegren's game, what I do think at times makes it so difficult is that he's supposed to have a skill set that they've just not really had on the, especially on the right side, right? For years and years. So it's, you know, is he tall or is he just in a photo with a bunch of short guys? You know, is she pretty or are all her friends ugly? Like, it's kind of one of those.
Maybe. Yeah, maybe.
Oh, I think definitely.
When he plays well, though, you can see it. Like, you
of
can
course.
See something. The problem is for him is confidence and focus.
Yeah.
Those are his problems. Like, focus has always been a thing for him. Even with the Marlies, it's like this guy, just like Space Cadet, just like not dialed in. I don't know. It could just be, you know, when you're at that level as an athlete, you just got to have a certain kind of brain that works a certain way. And he's got, it seems like he's got like a little bit of a different brain in general. And he's got to find ways to overcome that.
One of the first things I got, you know, like a inside scoop was about him when he was with the Marlies. And that was it, was brain. They didn't trust the brain. Like early on.
It was really, really obvious when he first came over, and he was just really slow making this decision, like painfully slow. It's like, what is he doing? And I think he's gotten better at that, but you see when he doesn't, when he's not feeling confident, then it's a different player.
Yeah, I think so, it was beyond that, though. It was more like they don't know if he has the hockey sense overall, and that's what ends up burying him, is that when things get tough, and he gets under, it's not just the confidence, it's that he doesn't have the processing power to make the plays.
Yeah. I mean, that's been the number one criticism of him for a long time. And, you know, he's moving into his prime. I think he's 24, probably closing in on 25. He's going to be an RFA. He's going to have arbitration rights. That contract's going to potentially be tough to do. And it's going to be a big decision for the Leafs.
Yeah, no, it is. Okay, last one. What are they doing with the goalies? Are you digging in on this yet? What's happening here? Because now it's getting into mystery mode here. Now I thought 100% Wool was going to get that game, and then he doesn't. Then he's not even playing. I don't understand what's going on here.
I think what they're trying to do is, I think Jones being the backup is just making sure that Wool doesn't have to play the day before he has to play tonight.
That makes sense.
I think that's all that it is. Because you're carrying three goalies, which is a really unusual situation. I think we're just not used to, when you're a team carrying three goalies, you might as well use the third guy on the back-to-back as the backup. Like, why not?
Yeah. No, that makes sense. I still don't know why Samsonov got four in a row. And I've been the biggest, like, hey, Samsonov's not terrible guy going. I think I'm the only person in the market that's not rooting for him to fail actively, because everyone's just cheering for their take that Wool is the guy. And my only position has always been, I don't know how we can be this definitive when he has less than 30 starts in his career and the other guy has been showing you some promise. But yeah, I also do think Wool is eventually going to be the guy, and that the organization has good reason to sort of be backing him in this way. But I, like, the four straight starts, can I give you a real conspiracy theory?
Sure.
Okay. Remember when I, what were we going to call the show? Conspiracy time? Yeah, I forget.
Conspiracy Corner, I think you said. Now it's time for Conspiracy Corner. Yeah, I said that's the name of the show.
Yeah, the Conspiracy Corner with J.D. Bunkus. this is how we'll close today. When they put Samsonov out there again, I thought, I wonder if Keefe is running him out there so many games in a row because they know that some of this is fraudulent, and they just say, if he's splitting the games, he might be able to confuse everybody and make it, he's getting hot and he's playing a good game, right? But if we're running him out there over another long stretch here, he'll eventually expose himself and we can finally just put in our young guy and say, see, we gave him a shot. This wasn't... You can kind of sell it to the room. You can sell it to Samsonov. Hey, we gave you a chance, but ultimately the chance was they were trying to give him enough rope to hang himself.
Yeah, I don't know the reason. I wonder. I mean, there's a couple of possibilities. Maybe
rank my conspiracy out of 10. 1 of 10. 10 is the best. That's a 10 out of 10 conspiracy. That it's you're getting the rope to fail.
I'm going to give that one a 3.
Oh, hurtful. I thought it was good. I thought it was...
They don't want him to fail. They want both the guys to be playing well.
Yeah,
so
that's why it's a crap.
Washington's the easier, probably the easier start, right? Like, that team can't score. They don't have much of a power play. Samsonov's record against Philly has been unbelievable in his career.
No, it made sense to play him in that one. He's also had the psychological issues versus Washington too, right? It's just, no. He's playing Ovi. He probably wants to let him score so he gets the goal scoring record. He's probably going to get out of the way of a couple of pucks to try to help out his buddy get to the record. Like, I don't know. I just...
They probably want to give Samsonov Edmonton too, right? So he probably split it up this way.
I think if Wool plays well tonight, you give Wool Edmonton again.
Mm-hmm.
That would be my opinion. Again, if they're going to play the hot hand thing, I think Samsonov, here's where I'm at with him in these last couple of games. I don't think that you can really blame him or fault him or say, ooh, he's been terrible. I still remain obsessed. I really don't, you know me, like I text you about this. I just immediately mute conversations on Twitter. I don't really see too much, but one guy got me the other day where he was like, Samsonov, you can't trust him because he melts down. And it was at the end of the Carolina game. And I went, how could anyone possibly blame him? It's like that's what gets me is when people have like the iconically bad takes where they're so embarrassing that I go, I have to like, this is crazy. This is lunacy. You got in my head with how a person could think this. But he also, I don't think, has been good enough to say he's the hot hand after these last two games. Play the other guy.
You were messaging me say don't respond to the reply guys last week.
I know, that's what I'm saying. I'm normally not a reply to the reply. But what I'm saying is like every once in a while, you'll never get me if it's, you know, you being mad or you're being a jerk. I'll just mute you. I mute the conversations most of the time anyway so that the only things I see are people I follow who interact with the tweet. But before the mute button, if you get in there with like an unbelievably strange opinion, it will haunt me. That's why I have to mute them. That's why
I think Samsonov's actually been pretty good. Like if you take the balance of his work,
man, since he came back and people go, oh, that's, you know, you're cherry picking. It's like, yeah, but it's like a cherry pick for a reason. Since he's been back, he's among starters who have 400 minutes played. I was looking up because you need to have a qualifier over that time of, you know, actual guys playing. He's like sixth in expected or goals above expected or goals saved above expected. He's like top 10 in every single category. He's just been a good goalie. He hasn't been overly spectacular. But the one I thought was interesting was like the expected goals saved. He's basically a fraction is separating him between the number two ranked guy, and he's got more of a gap between him and Connor Hellebuck in that time. And again, it's just one stat. We have enough now where you can stat anybody to death or kind of cherry pick and choose, but you go across and it's like he's been very good. The team in front of him has actually been better. They haven't been given up as many high dangers, and he hasn't been actually forced to, I think, be in those positions as much as we would think in our, you know, from our biases when we look at it, our eye tests. But ultimately, there isn't a number that you can find that tells you that he hasn't been good enough to be a playoff goalie since he returned in January.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think part of him melting down early in the year was the team was a complete mess. Mm-hmm. Like, remember when they're trotting Klingberg out there and they were just giving up so much. So,
yeah, but we played really well.
He did, and so did Jones.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so on the whole, the Leafs goaltending, on the whole, what they've got this year, I've seen some people have defended the Leafs and said the record's bad because Samsonov melted down there for a month and a half, and it's like, well, no, they've gotten pretty good goaltending performance overall because Wall's been good and Jones has been good and Samsonov has been good lately. So overall, you know, the goaltending was something that was talked about a lot coming into this year. I think they have to be okay with what they've gotten from their guys.
No, I don't understand the argument for that being the record because he's got a great record. The save percentage still isn't there, but the record is good. So, no, that has nothing to do with it. That's a quick dismissal. Like, you want to know what their record is with Samsonov?
It's great.
It's 18. It's 18-6. Like, I don't know what these people, who's making the case of what they were, two of those games, right? Like, what are we talking about here? That's wild. Don't tell me takes like that. Those stick in my brain. I just told you that I can't have the lunatic takes because they sit with me and then I think about them and I'm like, how do I tell this person? How do I change them? I can't help it. Anyways. All right, James, thanks for making time as always, brother. I'll talk to you next week.
Okay, sounds good. Thanks, JD.
See you, man. James Reynolds, Senior Managing Editor at The Athletic. I'm not going to even say because I don't want to give out this idea because someone could be listening and it'll steal my idea. But I have a good idea for a side show, a little side piece show.
That's not Conspiracy Corner.
No, not Conspiracy Corner. I just realized that Bill Simmons is Parent Corner, so I can't call it Conspiracy Corner.
That's okay. We can workshop the name.
Yeah.
Yeah, corner, like, A lot of people use that.
Yeah, coach's corner. Yeah.
Yeah. Conspiracy kitchen. Yeah, I like how you're cooking up conspiracies.
Yeah. Spell kitchen with a C.
Yeah, exactly.
But if we go down to an hour, that might have to be a new little thing.
Mm. Well, when we go down to an hour, there'll still be podcast only. And that's why you subscribe to this podcast. That's why you leave 5 stars. That's why you subscribe to this podcast, is so that you get the bonus content that's coming up very soon. Okay, quick break. Do you guys want history?
Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
So I just spent the earlier segment talking about how it's hard to find stakes during the remaining of the regular season in the NHL, especially for a team like the Toronto Maple Leafs. However, tonight, huge stakes for me personally. Because Toronto plays the Washington Capitals. I have been box score watching since fairly early in the season. Not at the very beginning, because to me, the goal scoring record was all but a certainty that it was going to be Alex Ovechkin's. But then he slumped. He did something very uncharacteristic. And currently, I think he's sitting now, because he hit 20 straight, I think he's sitting at 843 goals. The record is 894. Which is a sizable gap for a guy normally that would be in his 40s. But the thing about Alex Ovechkin was that he was aging in a way where we felt like it was going to be fine. He would still be able to find a way, and he would continue to chase this record no matter what. But now he's at 21 goals. Huge, huge slowing down from, like, these were the regular seasons since 2018. And these are just the full seasons, right? This is not the abbreviated year. 49, 51, 48, 50, 42. Lot. That pace, figured it was a lock. The series down to 21 goals, which is still pretty good considering he went as long as he did without scoring goals twice this year.
Yeah.
That he started to turn it up. By the way, I do want to mention that he's a dash 21. Like, it's pretty clear. Yeah, sure, plus minus, you can do that all the time. Washington's bad in their playoff spot, but he's a liability. He's not. This isn't a Sidney Crosby situation. I just want to make it very clear. He's aging well-ish for a guy who's 38 years old, but yeah, he still can score goals, but yeah, he's very much a liability. Anyways, I have been on record multiple times, and I've said my piece about it. I'm not rooting for Alex Ovechkin to pass Wayne Gretzky. Like, I'm rooting adamantly against it. I root against Ovi hard every single night. Every single night when I check, I will see the Capitals have 4 goals, and I will immediately on the Sportsnet app go, oh, let me see what the box score is. And then I see Ovi, and I actually, McKee and I text, and I go, no! And if he has 2, it's, no! Are you guys rooting for Ovi? Like, the rest of the 3 of you, do you want to see history? Because Ovi is the player of our, you know, of our vintage. Nick a little older, so maybe Gretzky is your guy, but like, you would have seen more Gretzky than us, but nah.
So here's,
yeah,
here's
Simon, the thing. Where you at?
His whole career.
Yeah.
Here's the thing. Getting older, one of the things I've got better at as a sports fan is recognizing greatness when I'm watching it, right? There was a stretch where I wasn't a big LeBron fan, and now I'm just like, you know what? One of the best to ever do it.
Yeah.
I enjoy watching greatness. I am not rooting for Alex Ovechkin to do this. I'm out.
Armin?
I'm out too.
Oh, yeah, okay. Nick?
Like I said, watched his whole career. No.
Yeah.
Gretzky.
Nice.
The boys are unified.
I usually like a little dissent amongst the ranks, and I know there's going to be some crybabies that are going to DM me and message me and be like, why is that an Ovi hater? It's not his fault. What's he supposed to do? First of all, there's a difference between not speaking out against stuff and being literally Putin's number one fancy boy. You know?
Just like trotted out, whatever.
Yeah. Being his biggest, like, he loves him.
He's a mascot.
Yeah. So, already against it. So, Also, I would just, in general, I would never cheer for the Russian guy to break the Canadian guy's record. Like,
especially in hockey,
in normal
right?
circles. Yeah, in hockey. Hockey, what sport? There's no sport. It's pickleball. I would be like, we need to keep the record. No, I don't want to see Gretzky not have that record. Of course not. So, yeah, I'm rooting against history. And so tonight, the stakes are high. It's just no. If you're watching this game,
there's some juice.
And Ovi scores, I'm going to be so mad at whoever's on the ice and responsible for him doing that. Because he scored the first time against them, and then he went, he was like, the Leafs are the only team he scored on, and then it was a gap of no one else. And I went, you losers couldn't be, you're the one group of cars that did it. Anyways, I'm anti-Ovi. It is what it is. I actually think that from a personality standpoint, a good for the game standpoint, like he's had a great career, and I never was against Ovi, and yeah, good teammate. Does a lot with kids and his community. Like, he gives time to people. I think that as a guy, I've known guys who have played with him, and they're always, whenever there's an Ovi story, you get kind of excited for it. Mm-hmm. I was rooting for him to win a Stanley Cup. I was never against him winning. When he won, I was thinking, damn, that's awesome. I'm so glad that one of the greatest players won a Stanley Cup. I hate when the greats don't win one. He is a great. I'm not trying to diminish any part of his career. I just want him to fall a little short here. That's all. Anyway, quick break. Let's come back. Greg Berube. Thrilled for our next guest. 3,149 PIMS. That's a lot. If you're not a fan of the sport, many. That's many. Stanley Cup winning head coach, 17 seasons in the NHL. It's Craig Berube. What's up, man? How are we doing?
Hey, good. How are you guys?
Great. Hey, thanks for doing this, man. It's great to have you.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
So, I saw you the other night doing the TNT broadcast. I was like, you know, flipping around the channels and watching. It was like a Vegas game. And you were sitting in there, and I went, oh, Rui's doing some media. Let's fire this up. Let's get him going. How are you, like, are you enjoying the media round stuff? I think it's usually hard for guys who are just stepping out of the coaching role, guys who are still very much embedded in the hockey world, to then translate to the spot that you guys hate the most.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, keeps me involved. And, I think just going in there, watching the games with the panel and things like that, it's a different perspective on everything. But I've liked it, to be honest with you. I mean, I think it's been fine. And I've enjoyed doing it. And like I said, you know, it just gives me a little different perspective looking at the game, watching the game, and then talking about it and things like that. So, Just trying to stay involved and keep busy a little bit.
Do you ever sit though with some of these guys and go, "You idiots! This is the kind of talk that cost me my job." Like the way that you guys talk about this stuff. Okay.
Nothing like that. Nothing that extreme.
Yeah. Did you get any media tips from our mutual friend Mark Savard?
Oh, Savvy.
Yeah.
not too much. You know, Savvy and I talk once in a while and just kind of keep in touch. We worked together in St. Louis for a bit, and we played together, Savvy and I. So we're pretty good friends, and, just seeing how I check in, see how he's doing in Calgary and what's going on.
Yeah, no, he was good here because he used to work for our station before you hired him, actually. That's the job that he went from, was working here doing the Leafs post games. And yeah, he was great. It was funny too, because, you know, all he would do here was criticize the Leafs power play. And then all of a sudden he was like, yeah, I'm going to actually go run the power play down there in St. Louis. I was like, all right, now you got your chance, Savvy. You better be good.
Better. He did a good job.
He did
a good job for us. Our power play was really good.
Yeah. I'm sure he never let you know about it.
He's a beauty boy.
Yeah, I know. He's probably real quiet about the power play stats. I'm sure he's just like never brought it up. He's like, oh, you know, you're like, hey, I've noticed the power play is doing well, Savvy. He's like, yeah, no, I did it. Okay, so I got to start with this one, though. Yesterday, there's a Leafs game, and the story, man, the Flyers, Torts, benches his captain, healthy scratches his captain. How did you feel watching that as a coach?
I was at the game and, Torts, that's what he does. And, you know, Couturier, his game has slipped lately. I think him missing a year and a half of hockey, I thought, you know, I've been watching the Flyers pretty close here. I'm here, living here. So, you know, his game was pretty good for quite some time. And, I think it's dropped. you know, in the last month quite a bit. You know, I think a lot has to do with missing so much time, but, you know, but Torts, you know, he has everybody in the same, you know, role. Like, if you're not playing well, I might sit you out. And I know he was named captain recently, but he sticks to his guns. You know, you got to give him credit for that. He wanted to sit Kateri out yesterday, and the team went out, and I thought the team played pretty well. I mean, I thought they were the better team for two periods, but, you know, Toronto scored a couple goals in the third, but they ended up winning the game. So I think, you know, he's just trying to, you know, try to fire up Kateri any way he can, but, you know, he's going to sit a game and see what happens next game, whether he's back in or not.
Mm-hmm. How difficult, though, you think that balance is in the room, right? Because he's your captain for a reason. And so the other guy's got to sort of be looking around and going, oof, okay. And my one thought was, you mentioned it with the third period, is Toronto almost comes back and there's a ton of posts. And if you lose that game, if you're Philly, and you're going, well, you know who probably would have been on the ice in a lot of those defensive situations is your defensive playing captain, right? Like, they kind of escaped with one, no?
Well, there's all kinds of things that could pop up, right? A win loss. Listen, nobody, I don't think anybody, you know, in the room, including Torts, wants to sit the captain on, you know, but that's just the way he does things. So, and I think the team understands that. I really do.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't see any letdown from their team right from the get-go in the game. They're playing their normal game. I know there was a lot of posts hit in the game by the Leafs. The Leafs, you know, obviously, they got some high-end skill guys that, you know, didn't finish last night. That's basically what it boils down to.
Mm-hmm. You know what, though? This is kind of – do you think it's harder in the modern day? Because we see this stuff, and, yes, it's rare to see a captain scratch. I don't think that this is like an any-era thing. But when you're – and you would probably relate to this as someone who has more of a reputation of being like a hard-nosed guy. You know, that was the way you were as a player. And, hey, you know, you're a no-nonsense type of dude. Getting guys in this era to buy in to what you're doing when you're trying to set a culture like that. Because the coaches of that vintage who do things like Tortorella, it's evaporating, right? Or it's shrinking. It's not going away entirely.
It's a fine line.
Yeah.
I think it's got to be a fine line. And I think that, you know, whatever team you take over and things like that, it's real important to get the leadership group set on your team and your leaders and understand that this is the way I'm going to do things. And you got to make sure that everybody understands that in the room. Mm-hmm. After I'm done, you got to take over in that room. You got to make sure things are, you know, going in the right direction, that they're not complaining after I leave the room and, you know, about the way I do things. It's your job as leaders to make sure that, hey, shut your mouth. This is the way things are done here, and this is what we're going to do. And your leaders have to lead by example and make sure that they're extending your right arm in that dressing room, whether it's in the room, on the ice, whatever, and take care of a lot of that stuff. That's really important. Mm. And if you don't have that, then it becomes real difficult.
Mm. Yeah. I think that's always, it's like you can only, that's like any industry, right? You can try to set the tone, but if you don't have other leaders around you, it's going to be difficult to execute.
Yeah, for sure. And like, it's more work for the leaders, but that's what, you know, leaders are. They got to do more. And that's why they got the C and the A's on their jerseys. And, you know, it's one thing to play well as a leader, but your job's not done. There's other things you got to take care of and do in the locker room and things like that. So that's a big part of it, in my opinion.
Yeah. You know what, though? I, in my experience, and again, different industries, but in my experience with leaders, like when you talk about, hey, there's going to be more on their shoulders, usually they establish themselves or they present themselves as leaders because they would have wanted it anyways, you know, like they were looking for it in the first place.
Yes, for sure. And I think it's really important when you're picking leaders and people on your team, whatever, in your jobs and all that stuff, that, you know, you're picking the right guys and they understand that there's more to it than just playing the game. You know, there's other things you got to make sure that you're doing and taking care of your teammates. And, you know, there's a lot that goes into it.
So, you know, you're at that game yesterday and you're watching the Leafs. So you get to see them up close and personal. And maybe this is too much of a media question, but when you're watching them And again, they're missing a couple of key guys, Marner specifically, but do they feel like a team when you're watching them that has an identity as we're heading into the final month of the season?
Yeah, that's a good question. And it's an unfair question because I haven't watched them that much, you know, that closely. You know, I see them play games, obviously, when I'm watching on TV and things like that. But, you know, last night I didn't feel like they played, you know, any kind of an identity game. I thought, you know, the game was a little bit sloppy, in my opinion, with the passing and the execution and things like that. But listen, they got, you know, Marner was missing last night, but they got some high-end players that can really, you know, do a good job. They obviously, their power play is dangerous, and they're an offensive team. That's the way I look at them. Like, you know, they score goals, and that's the way they try to win hockey games. You know, there's obviously parts of the game where they got to be better at, and they know that, and they're trying to get there before playoffs. So there's a lot of teams like that that they're trying to shore some things up in their game going into playoffs, so they're ready to roll. You know, we all know in playoffs that, you know, if you don't play good defense and you're not checking hard in the playoffs and you're not playing, you know, a straight north game and doing all the little things right, you know, you could be out pretty quickly.
Well, you know, actually, maybe we'll put it that way. Is there something, you know, you said you don't watch them every single night, but is there something when you do watch them, for example, and you said it, last night was a sloppy game and we're in the dog days, and so it's tough to get a complete picture. But is there something about them that whenever you watch, you like keeps coming back that you think about? Like, is there a question about them or a thought that you have or an observation about them that you feel like is consistent each time?
You know, I don't know. Like, again, that's a tough question for me, guys. I really, you know, I can't. It's hard for me to comment on them because I don't see them enough. You know, it really is. Like, I don't want to be make an unfair comment. They're a good team. Like, listen, they got, like I said, they got some real good players. You know, I think their goaltending's been a lot better, you know, doing things. But again, like, I'll go back to it, going into the playoffs, if you don't play direct and north in the playoffs and you're not dialed in defensively, it's an early exit.
Okay. So this is one that I'm having a tough time with too, is like, or where I empathize with them. Year over year, they're kind of sitting in this playoff format where the regular season games don't matter. Not don't matter completely, but overall with their standing, their positioning, they're basically going from, you know, February through April without a ton of stakes. And, you know, with you guys, everyone sort of pointed to, like, you know, your team in 2019, hey, they need to win all these games. They need to win all these games to get in the postseason. They need to turn their season around. So you get guys to buy in. But how did you do that? Because, you know, your guys were 23-6-4 from February, in February, March, and April combined. I was looking it up in 2019. And again, obviously you had the winning component to get into the playoffs. But how do you get your team to stay focused and remain bought in during a time that even for most teams is considered the dog days?
Yeah. Well, I think we did have to win a lot of games going forward. We were playing pretty good hockey in December too. We just weren't getting the wins. I think, you know, we were missing a goalie, and obviously Binnington came in and did a real good job. So we had a real good 1-2 combination with Jake Allen and Nett, and that was really important. But, you know, I think for the most part, from that time on, you know, people were, we had a they accepted their roles. They knew how we were playing the game. It was, you know, it's a simple North game we played. We checked hard, you know, and, you know, we really had a good camaraderie in our room, and our players, you know, really liked each other, enjoyed being around each other, and they played for each other. I think that was a message that we finally got across to our players. Listen, it's about the team. It's not about individuals. It's about the team, and it's about the success of the team. And I think, you know, we're four lines. We rolled four lines in 6D. That's the way we're built, our team. And, you know, that's why we had great success. And it never stopped. It's like we'd lose a game, but we're right back at it the next game. We're playing at a high level again. Mm-hmm. And that's the key. You know, you got to move on from losses. And I think going into the playoffs, we did that. Like, and in the playoffs, you're going to lose games, obviously, but you have to move on from it. You learn from your mistakes in that game, and then you're right back at it the next game. And we did a very good job of that in the playoffs. I don't know if we lost two in a row in the playoffs. Mm-hmm. I mean, we obviously lost games. The series were all pretty deep, six games, seven games on all of them. So we're very good at turning the page and getting ready to play the next game.
Yeah. Well, and you guys will always be a popular team here because you beat the Bruins. So thank God. There's always going to be that underlying gratitude that comes from this market. You know what is wild too about you is I always think is you're now the proof of concept coach for, hey, if another team wants to make a pivot and change directions and bring in the new voice or bring in the new guy in season to try to make that run, you're the kind of the face of that. And I'm curious if, you know, you don't need to name teams obviously, but did teams gauge your interest this year? Like what is your level of communication been with some of these other clubs that have, you know, looked at their situations at head coach during the season? How has that gone for you so far?
Yeah, not a lot, to be honest with you. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, it'll happen after the season. Like, I think a lot of these teams that made changes, they brought in interim coaches, whether assistants and things like that. And that was the direction they went. And so, you know, but, you know, like, so there hasn't been a lot of contact with me because, you know, they're still in the season and they're playing and they're focused on their stuff there. So, you know, I'm sure things after the season ends, you know, there'll be contact with teams and we'll see what happens.
Yeah. Was there ever a point in the year where you thought maybe I should scout the Leafs a little bit more?
I watch a lot of hockey. Yeah. I watch a lot of teams. I do. I mean, you know, I think, like I said, I don't look at it that way. I really don't.
Yeah.
These teams are playing. They have their coaches. Boom, that's great. You know, it's a tough job coaching. And, you know, there's a lot of changeover in coaches. We know that. It's a tough gig. But it's what we signed up for. And, you know, I had a great run in St. Louis, and I was let go. It was time to move on, and that's what I did. So I don't look at it like, oh, what job could I have? You know what I mean?
Of course.
I just patient. I've been enjoying my time at home with my family, doing some TV work and things like that, and try to get to some games in my area here to watch, you know, live, and then just trying to stay focused watching hockey on TV.
You did end up having a full camp with the Blues because you went from the interim tag to the actual coach. But your next opportunity, this is a weird way to say it, but are you actually kind of grateful that your next stop might be one where when you start with the team, it would be with the full camp rather than starting on the fly, even though you were there?
Yeah, I think, you know, whatever happens here, and I think the summertime is important too with, you know, setting goals and things like that with your players and the organization of what you want your team to look like and what you want to see. And then obviously training camp's important, getting a good camp in and, you know, kind of developing and creating a culture that you want going forward here, starting in training camp. You know, I think you can really build a good foundation in camp and what you want your team to look like and what you expect out of your players, night in and night out on the ice, obviously off the ice too. And, I think that's a good opportunity for a coach, rather than just stepping in the middle of the year, mm-hmm. not knowing a lot and just trying to figure things out.
So it's never easy to close an interview on a question like this. And I'm sorry for your loss. You lost a former teammate yesterday in Chris Simon. He passed away at age 52.
Yeah.
I wondered, you know, if you'd share a thought with our audience of what that guy was like, what it was like playing with him, and maybe, you know, some of the thoughts that you had yesterday after hearing about the tragic news.
I'm still sad. And, you know, Cy was a great, great teammate. I played with Cy and Wash for a few years. Actually, Cy and I were teammates in Philly too for a bit.
Mm.
But he got traded to Quebec with that big deal pretty young. But, you know, Cy was a guy that, you know, him and I had similar roles on the team. But he'd score goals, too. Cy was a pretty good hockey player. You know, he could score goals and had some good hands around the net and things like that. But I remember Simon, myself, and Dale Hunter were aligned. They formed this line going into the playoffs, and then we were aligned together throughout the playoffs. We went to the Stanley Cup Finals. So you know, it's just great having him on my line as a teammate. And like I said, he was a great person and great guy. And, you know, we shared a lot of time together. You know, it's just saddened for his family and everybody. And just what happened, I feel awful.
Yeah, I will say too, yeah, like yesterday, just looking through his hockey reference pages and the years that you two played together, you're right. It's the everyone does remember him as one of the scariest guys in the league, one of the most intimidating guys in the league for a stretch. But yeah. He seasoned Washington in 2000, he had 29 goals. Like when 29 goals meant more than 29 goals. You know what I'm saying? Like now.
Yeah, he could score goals.
Yeah.
He had a good shot and obviously his size and everything, and he had good hands. He'll be missed. He's, again, tremendous person, and he was a good hockey player.
Hey, Craig, again, really appreciate you making time, especially today. And, again, sorry for your loss, but I really appreciate you joining the show and having a chat with me today.
Okay, thanks for having me on. Take care.
Man. Craig Berube, Stanley Cup champion, 17 seasons in the NHL, and again, 3,141 PIMs. All right, let's take a quick break. Let's talk a little March Madness.
Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
All right, the dawn of March Madness is here.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Man.
It's your time.
Too high, man.
No, it's your time. Daniela and Francesca. What is your senior producer now?
I don't know. I don't get into particulars.
You want to know how the kid has a good role is that he just kind of got to make his own role.
That's huge, yeah.
That's very rare at a company, okay? Is when they were like, you decide what it is that you do.
That's stop buttering me up, man.
It's nice.
Stop.
Okay, but you are our March Madness guy. So this is one of your big, you've got this niche down, which is somehow in the shadows, you're able to watch Appalachian State on a Wednesday.
Try to follow as much as I can.
Yeah. I know you do. You follow a lot, and you'll know a lot. And I want to bring you in today because, you know, March is here. Mm-hmm. It's March. It's actually officially March. We got the first four.
Yeah.
I said it yesterday when I did my post, when I made my picks. By the way, 2 for 2.
Nice.
Completely, I said, not blind. I solicited some opinions.
Yeah. The 16s, it's just throw your hands up.
No,
and
I don't bet on
those.
I don't bet
on
the 16s.
You don't do the 16s.
Nah, I just feel like that's too much of a. Here's what I would say. If you're betting on the 16s, it's like when you bet on a coin flip.
Yes.
In the Super Bowl.
Sure.
Where you didn't have a feel for Wagner, right?
No. Yeah. Come
on. With 7 scholarship players?
Yeah. But I had gotten wind that Virginia was really fraudulent and that this was. There was like some real buzz about Tony Bennett being washed and not.
That was a tough watch.
Dude, that was. That's embarrassing for the you're trying to make the first four a thing, which I don't think it is still, like I'm as big of a March Madness fan as they come. I know you're a bigger college basketball fan, Daniela, but like I didn't care about the first four. I've never cared about the first four. I've never really wanted to watch the games. I kind of care about this one tonight because it's Buffalo and it's going to involve one of the players that we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it's the only chance we get to see him. So yeah, I'll watch this one with that eye. Unless there is a prospect of interest for me. In the first four, to me, it's kind of like, meh, call me Thursday. I'm going to be watching basketball for 4 straight days, basically completely unbothered other than when I have to do Leafs talks, in which I will be a little baby crying and stomping, doing the, like, my poor producers those nights because they take one extra second to set up the show and be like, hurry up. I don't want to be. Sam brings up I got one more thought on this game 72 of the Leafs. I'd be like, shut up. We got to go back and watch college basketball, please, for the love of God. But let's start with this. The top three players that you want to watch if you're a Raptors fan, because this draft, actually, no, wait, before we do the top three players, is this draft as bad as you think? Because everybody has kicked it in the face for basically 2 years now. And the Raptors did basically signal that they didn't care about this draft when they made the Poeltl trade and then kind of did the about face. I think part of their strategy this year in terms of acquiring some players like Olynyk and Agbaji was that they did not want to tank. Their hope was not to, they wanted to convey the pick this year. But what, in terms of the way that we've talked about it, do you actually see some value if the Raptors do end up with, like, let's say the 5 pick and what, 20, 21 with the Pacers pick?
Yeah. Right now, if you project based on standings and what have you. I think the Pacers pick will fall somewhere between 15 and 20. I think right now it's like 17.
Yeah.
So it's in that range, just outside the lottery territory.
I was being optimistic with the Raptors' first pick and then pessimistic with the second one.
Yeah, I know, because that's the big wild card here is, like, do you end up with the top six pick that is protected? So there's no guaranteed, well, I mean, nothing's really guaranteed, but there is no surefire bona fide stud atop the draft. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what's interesting, because this class is sandwiched between the Wembanyama draft and next year, where everybody's going to be oozing and mesmerized by Cooper Flagg. So because it falls between those two, where there's such a clear-cut number one atop the pecking order, mm-hmm. I feel like it's getting disrespected. That being said, these are the ones where I feel like you can find a lot of value if you're a team that drafts where the Raptors might be drafting, not necessarily with their first pick, but their second pick and their third pick, which will be either 31 or 32, where there are a lot of guys that are veteran, seasoned players at the college level that can make an impact. The ceiling might not be as high, but the floor is still very strong. So traditionally, you go into the draft, especially with those first 14 picks, that lottery, you're looking for super high ceiling players. The problem here is, well, it's unclear. And I think part of it can be attributed to the fact that there are a lot of international guys that nobody's ever seen. Like, you're never going to... The best thing I can tell you is there's a guy, Alexander Sarr, who's a French... another Frenchman who's a seven-footer.
Yeah.
All I know about him, to be honest with you, he's the brother of Olivier Sarr that played at Kentucky. That's all I can tell you.
Here's what I can tell you.
Because I've seen his brother play. I can't tell you I've seen Alexander Sarr play.
Here's what I promise you. There's no way in hell that back-to-back years... 2 7-foot French guys work, and both are good.
Yeah, and I have a feeling Wemby's good.
I'll bet my life on it. There is no way. Anyways, keep going.
No, but that is part of the reason I think this class is being disrespected.
Mm-hmm.
But you can find value. There's always value. There are guys that are capable, that have proven themselves at the college level, whether they're freshmen or upperclassmen, that can come in and have a role. I think part of why there's a lot of skepticism towards this class is because the top end talent doesn't have the high ceiling that you would typically want mm-hmm. if you're investing a top five pick, a top three pick, or even the number one pick. It's not clear cut. There is no consensus. And that's part of the reason why it's a little bit disrespected.
Well, and I think that too, the tournament this year is pretty muted for two reasons. One is that by far the biggest star in college sports right now is on the women's bracket.
For sure. Yeah.
Like, it's not comparable.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
not even close.
Yeah. Like, Caitlin Clark is, at this point, I think one of the most famous female athletes who's ever lived already.
Yep.
And from the men's bracket side, it's the guy. Like, is the guy playing tonight the most famous, most coveted? It's Cody Williams. And he's not even – this is what's funny is – so I obviously – he's on the Colorado Buffaloes, first of all. It's like, this isn't Deion Sanders in NCAA football, okay? So, like, this is a program that historically has had nobody, okay? They don't have guys. He's the brother of an NBA player, Jalen Williams, who's on Oklahoma City, who's one of – Jalen Williams is a popular, nerdy basketball fan going, you know who's really good?
For sure,
it's like,
yeah.
That's a super hipster pick is to be like Oklahoma City, the team that plays at 8 o'clock where he's the, you know, number three banana on the team, but kind of he's actually the two. He's a very hipster, good pick for a player. But I don't know if I'll ever see in my lifetime or number one guy play at Colorado again. But what's crazy is, so I tune in and watch their game the other night, and I'm like, oh, okay, they're on. I throw them on a second screen. He's not even their guy.
No.
No, he's not. He's like the number three on the team. And I'm going, oh my God, how am I even supposed to evaluate this? This is harder than even like the Brandon Miller stuff where I went, what are we looking at here? What are we watching here? Okay, is he the guy to you that's at the top of, like, if let's power rank it as the guys in the tournament, mm-hmm. number one player to watch, that would be like the dream player to fall to the Raptors if they pick five or six. Is he the guy or is it somebody else to you?
No, he would probably be it because of all the top end talent that is going to be discussed towards the front end of the draft. He's
so
probably
watch
the highest
tonight
upside
if you're a Raptors
guy.
Fan.
100% watch. Yeah. 100%. Well, what's interesting is his value it's vacillated between being the number one pick and potentially going down to where the Raptors
I've seen him at 8.
Right? Like, you see it. It's pretty weird. And it tells you that a lot of the scouts and a lot of these experts have no idea in terms of what we're going to see. I actually think the workout process, the draft process, all the time leading up, just like you see in the NFL, it's actually probably going to be more valuable this year because now those teams are going to get a better appreciation and indication of what the skill level is when they get them inside their own building, on their own court, in the facility. And I think that's a case where Cody Williams' stock is either going to soar or it's going to plateau, and we're going to see him potentially get picked after five, which is a surprise. But yes, because athletically, he does things that I don't know if there's any other prospect at the top end of the draft is capable of. So for that reason alone, if you're looking for guys from the tournament, 100%, he would be the most appealing.
Well, and there's proof of concept with his brother, too, right?
Oh, no, like no question. And his brother, if you, I mean, heck, played at Santa Clara.
Yeah, yeah, right? That's what I mean. It's like you've seen basically a preview of what he could be for you.
Also with him, we're talking about plays a similar style, capable of doing similar things. But with Cody Williams, he's bigger and he's more athletic on top of that. So his brother has had instant success after being a guy that was very much underrated going throughout his entire career. Last year, there was some buzz coming out towards the end of his college career at Santa Clara, but wasn't a guy that was always highly touted, much discussed. If anything, though, the fact that he's instantly been able to adapt and have success, I think plays well to his brother, who is the more naturally gifted prospect overall.
Okay, so then let's move to other names.
Yeah.
Because he's the... So I think what we're driving at here is he is sort of the consensus most likely to be... The top North American pick.
Possibly.
Okay, but now, so if you're a Raptor, again, we're framing this through the lens of if you're a Raptors fan, you're a Toronto fan watching this tournament. Mm-hmm. I guess if you're a fan of any team, but the players that you want to watch, because none of them are overly famous, and so, you know, this is sort of a preview of getting you to know some of the characters in this. People know who Zach Edey is, I think. You should know who Zach Edey is. If you're a Canadian basketball fan, that's kind of the bar is, you know.
He's been around. Yeah. He's been on the national,
That's what
you
I'm saying.
Be familiar
and
with
he's
him.
The monster.
Exactly, yeah.
The big one.
Yeah, he's the big guy. One. Okay?
The big
he's,
one.
He's the big guy that choked last year and embarrassed everybody. It's whatever. Oh, they're just
he
kidding.
Didn't choke, actually. Yeah, he didn't really choke.
If you lose.
No, you know what's interesting about that? Not to go off on the Purdue or go to Zach Edey for a second, but, I mean, Purdue's ceiling as a team will be dictated by their guards. It's not by him. Sure. That guy's going to get 20 and 10 easy regardless. Yeah. He's going to, and he did it in their first round game last year against FDU. It's not that he was unproductive. It was that they couldn't adjust to the game plan that FDU had crafted, which was we're going to press their guards, make them uncomfortable, and anytime he touches it, we're going to send a double.
Sure.
Can he make decisions? And he still put up decent numbers, and he's going to be a 20 and 10 guy. He'll do it in his sleep. It's just can the guards, Braden Smith, Lance Jones, Fletcher Lawyer, are they going to make enough shots and control pressure? Like, how are they going to play under pressure? Yeah, that's what counts for them.
You know what the problem is, though, with the college thing is if you're supposed to be college Shaq, where you've got this incredible advantage, I don't want 20 and 10 from you in a pivotal game. I want 30 and 15, you know? And so I do think he bears some...
But he's not really that.
But that's what I'm saying. But from a physical... You're playing a 16 seed? You better... Are you kidding? You're playing a 16 seed? You're the player of the country?
Yeah, but he's not... He shouldn't be in the same breath as Shaq.
No. I don't think he's Shaq. I'm saying that your college Shaq to the 16 team... When they're warming up against you, they got to be looking over there thinking the same feeling that guys had looking over, that Scott Pollard had when he looked over a check, like, well, how am I going to defend that guy? What am I supposed to do here? This isn't fair.
I don't know. I view it a little bit differently.
Sure.
Just because... Because
you love college and...
Well, yeah. Also, though, those guys are, whatever we want to say, like, those that FDU team, they had athletes. They had guys that know how to play the game.
Yeah.
And their size. We're not talking about a D1 team versus a D2 team. And then you're saying, okay, man, like, you're 6 inches taller than every other person on the court. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. All you got to do is put your hands up.
I think that's
even if
the
you
case.
Have two bodies on. Yeah. That was not the case. Yeah. I can tell you. I can assure you. That was
put
not
your hands
the case.
Up. Dunk
that
it.
Was not
Flash
the case.
Zachy,
that
you
was
get
not
35 points in
and,
that game.
And knowing what the development story is behind that player is important. Like, Shaq was, for example,
I'm saying,
it's interesting with him, the story, the development arc for that player is a guy that, honestly, I think he's exceeded any level of ceiling I ever thought he could have.
Awesome.
I saw him play. My brother played against him. I've seen him play in person before when he was, you know, 17, 18 years old, coming straight out of Toronto, Northern Kings, with no experience, going to Purdue. And I thought, man, how you do that? It's all basically because you're taller than everybody. That's essentially what it was. But I never thought he would be in a position where he would be agile enough, where he would be able to be competent enough defensively and pick and roll in space. But credit to him. He's improved. And credit to their staff because they've gotten him to that level.
You know what, though? It's funny with the draft stock with him. I want to get back to the two guys. This will be my final thought. But so I'm watching the T-Wolves the other night. And you know who comes out? He might know. I don't know if Simon will know. Armin, do you know? Who am I thinking of college-wise that stepped on the floor for the T-Wolves? Knocked down his first three, actually. I went, oh, yeah. And then the rest of the game was a nightmare for him.
Oh, Canadian?
I thought Leonard Miller. Yeah, sorry. No, I went Canadian Leonard Miller.
No. Garza.
Luka.
I
was second most famous basketball player.
That's what I'm saying is you watch some of these guys, and I went, how can this dude not at least give you a couple minutes in the NBA, and you remember how difficult it is and how much that agility does matter and how much that ability does
100%.
Matter. And it's like, that's what I think with Zach Edey.
Yes.
If Luka Garza can't play in the NBA, guess who ain't playing in the NBA? Zach Edey. It ain't happening. But he can be useful for them, you know, come international time, because having seven-footers in the international game is massive.
Also, There's no defensive three in the key room.
That's what I'm saying.
That's the beauty of it.
No, but that's why.
That's real basketball.
That's why it's huge, huge, huge to have them there. And so, actually, maybe if they end up changing that rule, right? We have that discussion.
Yeah, you never know.
It's like, hey, how does basketball? But now they've already figured out with the refs. But if they ever went that drastic, then Zach Edey, step on up. You're ready.
Max player.
So we established that Cody Williams is the number one guy. Give me your number two and then number three players to watch in this tournament. Again, from a Raptors draft fan standpoint or just an excitement standpoint overall, too.
Yeah,
they can't be like a senior.
No, who's going to tear it up.
But who ends up being a second round pick, right? Like, I actually just interviewed Mike Bibby.
Yep.
And he's the reason I got into college basketball, his Arizona Wildcats teams.
Miles Simon.
But that's it, is that, like, my first basketball love was Miles Simon. And when I was a kid, I went, how is he a second-round pick? This doesn't make any sense. He's the best guy on the championship team. So we don't want anybody that's like, you got to watch this guy. No, he's a 50-year senior. This is his year. I want the guys who are going to be exciting, but also who people want to, like, teams are going to be interested in trying to draft.
Yeah, I tried to come as prepared as possible in terms of even going based on draft slot.
I know, you got your book.
So if we're going, let's say, hypothetically, they are able to retain the pick, that first pick, so it's a top six pick. If we're talking in that range, okay. The one, I love this kid. I really love him. Talk about, you don't want the wily veterans. This is not a wily veteran. It's a young cat, but he plays like a wily veteran. Mm-hmm. Reed Sheppard out of Kentucky, man.
Yeah, okay.
God almighty. I love Reed Sheppard. I really love him. And he plays with the poise of a four-year college player as a freshman. And you're not going to see this guy start the game. He's going to come off the bench. It's like Rob Dillingham comes off the bench. But Reed Sheppard's going to be there in the closing moments in crunch time, and he's going to have the ball. If Kentucky is going anywhere, if they are in close games in March, all season long it's been the case, he is the one with the ball in his hands. And on top of that, I got to say, one underrated skill that I really appreciate about his game, because you look at the physical tools, and he's 6'3", so he's got, he doesn't have, you know, traditional NBA size in terms of, even at the guard position, you're talking nowadays is like 6'4", 6'5", and up. He's 6'3". He doesn't jump off the page with his athleticism. He's actually deceptively athletic, and if you watch him in space and the ability to get to the rim.
By the way, so our audience knows deceptively athletic means this kid's white. So
he's white. He's a white guy. Yeah, he's a white guy. His dad played at Kentucky. Yes. Well, I would say the same thing about, like, Rob Dillingham, who's around the same size. Only difference, because now those two guys will be probably projected very similarly in terms of their draft stock, right? They're going to be right next to each other in a lot of mocks and what have you, or separated by a couple picks. To me, Reed Sheppard's the more well-rounded of the two players. And there's a skill that he possesses that I think is incredibly underrated. He's an awesome, awesome transition initiator, a fast break starter, a guy that outlets the ball, sees the floor incredibly well. His vision in transition is remarkable. I really, really am a big fan. And this is a guy coming in who was a five-star recruit, obviously an elite freshman talent, but out of that freshman class that everybody that's been heralded as the top recruiting class in the nation, he was number five in that pecking order. And yet he's proven to be their most important player. Every time he's on the court, he makes an impact. He can shoot the three really well. He can create off the dribble. He can facilitate. And like I said, I think the biggest testament to how good he can be and to how important he is the fact that when the games matter, and you get to those crunch time moments, he's the one that they lean on.
Okay. So that's a good one. I will say this, that when, just from the eye shape, when I look at a bracket, I try to do my initial, hey, what feels like an upset? Yeah. Oakland, Kentucky.
No question.
Feels like that's a scary game. That's a 100%. That's a scary game for Kentucky as a three seed. But okay, I'm hoping, Normally, I would have rooted for Oakland because I, you know, yeah, root against Cal.
And you like dogs, too. I mean,
I like dogs, yeah. And it's tournament. It's dog season. It's like, this is the time. But I'm moving off that pick purely because I want to see the two Kentucky kids go deeper and actually get more of a stress test on them.
For sure. That's a great point. And with Kentucky, the biggest thing is they're super boom or bust. Yeah. They're going to vacillate between being a national championship contending team or, as you put it, they could lose in the first round.
Okay.
That's how crazy they are. Like, it's that much of a drastic swing. Because one day they look like this championship caliber team. The next you'll watch them like in the SEC tournament.
Yeah.
And you're just like, nope, can't do it. And it's a lot of it is defensive oriented. Mind you, this is another upside of Reed Sheppard. The kid can defend.
No, but this is this. I really like this pick, though, just because I think if I had to guess who are going to be your guys, I would have guessed Dillingham was going to be on the list of, hey, you got to watch this dude, because he's very much a...
It's flashy.
Well, yeah, but I think that there's also been now a history of Kentucky guards that, you know, got a little overlooked because they didn't do enough at Kentucky, like Shea, and they, you know, that...
Maxie.
And then the hit rate on them is high.
Yeah, exactly. Then they get to the NBA and they get underdrafted and everyone goes, what the hell were you doing? Just take the Kentucky guard. Like, they went out and recruited him for a reason. Why are you letting him slip down in the draft so you can take someone from, you know, Iowa State? This is stupid. Don't overthink it. So I think Dillingham represents that this year, right? From, again, casual observer who's floating in and trying to do all of his research now. But throughout the year, I got Dillingham buzz. And people going, Dillingham. And I've seen Dillingham basically photoshopped into every jersey of lottery teams going, please go get him. And I think it is because of more of that Maxi Shea effect than it is actually what he has done so far in college. Mm-hmm. Okay, so who's number three? Who's the last guy that we're watching?
You know what? Based on, again, draft slot, I would say Jacoby Walter from Baylor.
Okay.
I was tempted
to say... I have
no
idea who this is.
No,
now this is a first Google.
Five-star freshman.
Okay.
Five-star freshman.
We're Googling now. Jacoby spelt J-A and then Kobe.
Yeah, Kobe. Yeah, it was the apostrophe there.
That's a good one.
Yeah, no, it's good.
I got to say, I really like that name.
It's a fun one, and he's a fun player to watch, man. Yeah. Like, he's an explosive offensive player, repertoire, bag, deep. Mm-hmm. He can create his own shot, and he shoots the ball well from three, which is important, obviously. 6'5", he's got the size. He projects as like a more of a two guard than a wing player per se. But on a team, especially when I thought about, okay, Raptors fits. Because the other guy that popped into my mind was Stephon Castle from UConn, who's a freshman as well. And anytime you can go and be a starter on the number one team in the country, you're doing something right. But the biggest problem with Stephon Castle is it's been very inconsistent, and he has proven time and again he can't shoot consistently from three. Also, doesn't take, he's not a high volume guy, but percentages wise, I mean, he's shooting like 25% or something. It's not great.
Did he shoot free throws well?
No.
Okay, then I'm right off.
Playmaker, no question. Like, pure talent is very enticing. But if we're talking about the more polished of that type of player, it's Jacoby Walter out of Baylor.
Okay.
And he's been on a team that had a lot of transfers and turnover from years past. He's another guy that stepped right in immediately and became a very important, impactful player for Baylor. If you recall, I mean, last year, Keontae George, who is now with Utah and is playing very well in the NBA, was elite for Baylor.
Mm-hmm.
I think Jacoby Walter is a bit more well-rounded. Maybe doesn't have the same offensive ceiling that Keontae George has, but I do think Jacoby Walter is overall a more appealing, well-rounded prospect.
I got to tell you, though, I resent you for the segment just for the standpoint of it's round one, and you're forcing me to root for two choker franchises in three seeds, which is Kentucky and Baylor. Is like, these are two teams that routinely let you down in the tournament.
Baylor's playing Colgate, man.
Yeah.
And I very much have been sort of torn on it because Baylor has a younger team.
Mm-hmm.
They have a lot of transfers. Ray J. Dennis is one of them. Yves Misi, who's actually somebody that should be on, if you want to talk about another guy, keep on your radar. Because I think the Raptors, if they end up having three picks,
they will.
One will probably be, should be, a big of some kind.
Mm-hmm.
Some kind. And if we're talking about bigs to watch, Yves Misi, who's a freshman out of Baylor, 7-footer, my God, this guy runs the floor like a gazelle.
So unbelievable. Double Baylor. Raptors fans.
He plays a very much, his play resembles Raptors style of basketball.
Mm-hmm.
High energy, up and down, finish around the basket, defend like crazy, block shots, be a rim protector. I like him a lot.
So I think what we're settling on here is that Baylor is the Toronto team.
Well, here's the thing, though.
Like, gone to Purdue because I think everyone's going to root for Edie.
Yeah, for sure.
Like, everybody's deep down is going to root for Edie and not to have another choke, in my opinion, not in Danielle's. The opinions of the guy whose name's on the show is that that's a huge joke. If you're the one seed and you're the best player,
okay, yes,
you bear some responsibility for losing to the 16 seed. But the team, I think where we're kind of settling in is Baylor might be the Toronto's number two team.
Quick zag, though. Yeah. So Baylor's got Colgate. And look, I don't understand necessarily what all the scribblings on Danielle's sheet is, but he does have Colgate circled twice.
I did pick
twice,
Colgate. Actually,
you picked Colgate.
No, I did not pick
against our team.
I did not pick them to win. Okay. But I do this thing every year. Myself and a group of friends that went to university together, a few years ago created this. This concept is called Bracket Busters, and we all draft teams ranked 9 through 16. So all the teams that are obviously the lower-seeded teams, underdogs. And so my two teams this year were Drake, and I ended up with Colgate. It's a draft-style format, so you kind of go through it.
Okay, if you had the first two picks, who would you take, though, in this draft?
Okay, so I love McNeese.
Okay.
Oh, I love McNeese. Yes. And here's why.
Part of it is everybody write this down.
Part of it is the matchup.
By the way, everybody try to spell McNeese and see how many different variations we come up with. Tweet at me, at JDBuggers, how many times that you get McNeese, how you spelt it. No looking how you did it first try.
Here, you'll land on the team and the proper profile if you type in to any effect McNeese FBI. You want to know why? Because their coach is Will Wade, who was ousted from LSU because of an extensive FBI investigation.
Oh, yeah. I love this.
Now, yeah, I love this.
I also love McNeese.
They know how to rig it.
It's fantastic. This team went from 11-23 last year without Will Wade. He's in his first year. He comes over. Boom, 30-3. Yeah.
Let's go.
Loaded with backcourt talent through the wazoo. It's really fun. I like them. And I also think, and this pains me because, I mean, you know I love my Nembhards. Ryan is on Gonzaga. They are playing the Zags, but I think the Zags are incredibly fraudulent. Mm. They have two quality wins.
Me thinking the Zags
two
are incredibly fraudulent
wins.
Feeds every. Well, I'm in.
I love it. Also, I mean, think. But here's the thing, right? Everybody will be penciling in Gonzaga. Don't sleep on. They've made eight straight Sweet 16s. Eight straight. McNeese, though, something about them, man. I'm telling you, something about that team. Okay. I am really
He's
high
number
on.
Two.
I love this.
Okay, there's a couple, but I'll go with I'll go with another double digit seed. New Mexico.
Don't worry. Hey, guess what? Between you and I, texting, I'll get them all.
Okay. New Mexico.
Get ready to see my name in the top of your phone for a while. Yeah, New Mexico.
The Lobos.
They've got two in the first round.
Yeah.
Who's New Mexico guy? They're playing six seed. Is it South Carolina?
By the way, I spelled McNeese correctly.
I have it
the
in front of me.
First try. Not to brag.
Nice. Well done. But the Cowboys of McNeese.
Well, that's what I was going to say is what are they? Because the logo is a little blue guy riding a yellow horse. I was like, okay, it's Cowboys.
Yeah, they got Clemson. Okay. I feel like that's a really good matchup for them. Jalen House, veteran guard, son of Eddie House, former NBA guard.
Ooh, I'm in.
Love that.
This kid bounced around a little bit, but was a very prodigious high school talent. Highly regarded. Mike Bibby actually coached him in high school. He's one of their lead guards.
Yeah.
And they're talk about a team that it's an 11 seed. They had to run through their conference tournament win and get in. Sure enough, they did. But they have a lot of NBA caliber size and athletes across the board. And I think it's really intriguing. So Jamal Mashburn's another really good player. I think I like their matchup against Clemson. I really do.
Okay, here's my advice to you. People should follow you at Daniele_media. It's Daniele_media. Share the picks with people, okay? Don't just make me be the conduit. Share some picks with the people. We got to go. Subscribe to the podcast. Leave 5 stars. Do all those things. Follow on Twitter and Instagram at JD Bunkus. And, I'll be sharing picks. 2 for 2 yesterday.
Well done.
Huge start. Feeling good. Feeling red hot. Overly confident. We're back tomorrow with Mike Bibby and Dave Damshek.